And they began to find, buried in the desert sands, evidence of large fields of sand that has been fused, melted into sheets of glass from a rapid, intense heat. What would cause that kind of heat so long ago? There's no evidence of any meteors or meteor impact, anything like that. While lightning can sometimes do it in small sections, we're looking at areas that are measured in square miles. What could cause something like that to happen? Archaeologists began to find lumps of clay inside the buildings, and it was a bit of a mystery at first, precisely what these lumps were all about. Now we know that these were actually clay vases and bowls that were melted under a rapid, intense heat. They collapsed into the balls of clay that we see today. What could cause that kind of heat? The walls and the floors of the buildings are all that remain today, and many of them are made out of natural stone. The stone has been scorched by a very rapid, very intense heat. The word that archaeologists use is vitrified. While the walls were exposed to the intense heat, the grains of quartz, for example, in the granite have been melted. So the walls are still in place, but the grains of sand or the grains of the quartz have been melted. What could cause that kind of heat 5,000 years ago? Well, when human skeletons were discovered on the base of the excavations on the ground level, they began to give us additional clues. Many of the skeletons were strewn throughout the streets. They looked like they were running away from something and maybe didn't have time to get away. Some of the skeletons were still holding hands. Researchers Peter Stearns, Michael Adas, Stuart Schwartz, in their book World Civilizations, published in 1992, they talk about this. And they have a quote. They say, groups of the skeletons in postures of flight have been found on the stairways at some of the sites. These people were running from something and simply didn't get away in time. What happened? What happened to them so long ago? Well, there's one skeleton that stands out above all others. It may begin to give us some insight. And if you have not heard this information, this may be surprising to you. The skeleton that was found, a human skeleton in a site near Rajasthan, just north of Delhi. The skeleton was discovered in the 1960s. By Russian archaeologists, and it's published in a Russian book entitled Riddles of Ancient History by A. Gorbovsky, 1992. The skeleton is 50 times more radioactive than it should be simply from lying in the ground and absorbing background radiation and the radiation from the atmosphere. What would cause that kind of radiation in a human skeleton 5,000 years ago? Well, we don't know the answer to these questions. And to some degree, we're still speculating. All we see is the evidence. Something happened to these people. Their civilization was destroyed. There was a rapid, intense heat. It vitrified their walls. It melted their pots, scorched the walls, and fused the sand in the desert around their cities into sheets of glass. We don't know precisely what happened to that. One of the interesting things that we find across civilizations throughout time and throughout the world is that often when a great event has occurred in our past, the memory of that event is preserved through the myths and the stories that are told hundreds or even thousands of years later. And while each story may have inaccuracies specifically, in general, when you put them all together, they point to something that may have been factual, something that actually happened. Well, in this part of the world, northern India and what is now Pakistan, there is one text that describes a great battle that happened on the plains of Rajasthan long, long ago. It is a text that describes what has always been believed to be a mythological battle between the forces of good and evil, or light and dark. The text is called the ancient Mahabharata, the Mahabharata. It is also known as the Hindu Bible, and it is an epic poem, if you will, that is over 100,000 verses long. If you've ever read the Bhagavad Gita or heard of the Bhagavad Gita, it is one portion of this greater epic that is called the Mahabharata. And the essence of the Mahabharata is that it tells the story of a battle, a great battle between two highly advanced civilizations that happened long, long ago. And the battle resulted in the destruction of both civilizations. No one won this war, essentially. The descriptions of the weapons that are used in this battle are now the descriptions that become very, very interesting to modern scientists. Because until the mid-20th century, we knew of no weapons that would match the power or the impact of the weapons described in the Mahabharata. It was only with the detonation of the first atomic bomb, the Trinity test site in 1945, that we saw the effects in the desert that anywhere parallel what we saw, or what archaeologists are seeing now, on the plains of northern Rajasthan. And it was with that site and with that technology that the physicist responsible for the weapon actually quoted the Bhagavad Gita. And there's a section in the Bhagavad Gita where the great Hindu god actually says, "Now I have become the destruction, I become the death." And this was the quote that was muttered under the breath of one of the researchers, one of the scientists who actually had the opportunity to see the first bomb. Well, in the technology that was used, according to the Mahabharata, weapons of war were created, mysterious weapons with forces and effects that had never been seen before. And they're described. I'm going to share some of the descriptions with you. These are direct quotes. Some of them are very generalized and could certainly apply to any weapon. Others are much more specific. The Mahabharata states that the weapon was detonated as an iron thunderbolt and burst as brilliant as 10,000 suns in the sky, a single projectile that was charged with all the power of the universe. That's very general. That could mean a lot of things. But then it becomes very specific. It says, when this weapon was detonated, it released a tremendous heat on the surface of the earth. And in that heat, living elephants burst into flames in mid-stride as they were walking across the deserts. It says that the waters of the streams and the rivers boiled, killing all of the fish, that birds in the sky turned to ash and fell from the sky, and that human corpses were not even recognizable because their hair and their fingernails had fallen out and their skin was burned so tremendously in the presence of this weapon. If you've never heard any of this before and you'd like to find out more information, there are a number of translations of the Mahabharata. Pratap Chandra Roy, in his translation, pages 446 to 481, gives much more detail. I'm just giving some generalizations here. What could create that kind of an effect in a battlefield weapon 5,000 years ago? Well, up until fairly recently, no one really took the possibility seriously that ancient civilizations could have had any kind of nuclear or atomic weaponry. It was Nobel Prize-winning chemist Frederick Soddy that actually suggested that perhaps at some point in our distant past, in the mists of our ancient memory, maybe we have had atomic weapons in the past. And if we did, then the question is, did we survive the learning curve? Did we know how to apply those weapons to benefit us? Or is the reason that those civilizations no longer exist because the weapons were used to destroy one another in a battle that no one won? And if this is the case, we've got to ask ourselves the question, are we reliving the past? Are we making the same mistakes again? In our world today, with over one half of the world's nations now engaged in armed conflict, we've got to ask that question seriously. And it brings us right back to the point where we began our program. Is there a principle that allows us to see ourselves differently, to look differently at one another, to become greater than the differences that led to the wars of our past, so that we don't have to make those kinds of mistakes? How do we unleash the power of the message in ourselves? As an engineer working in the late 1980s during the time of the Cold War, this is the question that I asked myself. My sense was that if we were ever going to find a single unifying principle, it would have to be a principle that included every human on the face of the earth. It couldn't be a principle that applied only to some and not to others. It would have to be something that was not tied to any one belief, any one religion, any one tradition. It would have to be something that transcended all of them together. And the place that made sense to look for that principle was inside the mystery of life itself, inside the human body. Now we know there's a message in ourselves. And while we have yet to translate the entire message, what we do know is the very first layer, that introduction, is a potent, powerful message. It gives us a reason to think differently about ourselves. God eternal within the body. God eternal within the body.